Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
Today's program is brought to you by Whole Foods Market, a dynamic leader in the quality food business, a mission-driven company that aims to set the standards of excellence for food retailers. For more information, visit wholefoodsmarket.com.
I'm Erin Fairbanks, host of The Farm Report. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Hi, and welcome to A Taste of the Past. I'm your host, Linda Palacio, on this half-hour journey through culinary history. And you know, most of us, when we're cooking, don't realize that we take a journey across the world and around the world every time we reach into our spice cabinet, evoking flavors of Middle Eastern cuisines or Chinese cuisines or Southern Mexican cuisines. And this use of spices really, if you look into it, is very, very important in the history of our culture, of cultures around the world, and certainly in the culinary globalization of cultures. And here today to talk with me, actually he's not here, he's in Texas, but we've got him on the line, is someone who's done a lot of work on the history of spices and has even taken travels to go and uncover a lot of what's going on in, or what went on in, the world of spice trading. And that is Gary Paul Nabin. And Gary is actually an ethnobotanist and food anthropologist. And when I first picked up this book, I was a little surprised because I know him from his work on saving seeds and apples and heritage fruits and vegetables. This is a an extension work, I would say. But what a wonderful trip it was to read this book. I felt like I was traveling along with him. Gary, welcome.
It's so great to be with you, Linda. Thank you.
You know this, and I say that with this book. The book is called Cumin, Camels, and Caravans, A Spice Odyssey. And, you know, as I was reading it, I couldn't help but kind of relate it to Paul Coelho's The Alchemist. It just took me out there on the desert, and I was looking at camels, and I was feeling the communal tribesmen talking. Not only did you, as I said in the beginning, do a lot of historical research on spices, you actually went and traveled those routes, the four different major routes, correct?
That's right. Over a matter of 8 years, I had the blessing and opportunity to travel to 14 different countries on five continents, looking at spice trade routes and interviewing spice traders, some of whom had inherited that profession from 5 to 10 to 15 generations of their own family before them.
Well, in fact, you even said that your family, you could trace your family back to having been spice traders.
That's right. My grandfathers, who came to this country from Lebanon and Syria, were spice peddlers and fruit peddlers. And my family has had spice trade businesses in Lebanon, Syria, Oman, and Yemen over millennia that we can trace it. The Arabs are as good at genealogy records as the Mormons are, so I've been fortunate to pick up some of that.
Well, what I found so interesting, I mean, I guess the overlying topic or underlying the main thrust of your work to me speaks to how we maybe really don't understand culinary globalization and how early it all began. I mean, so many historians claim that it began, of course, with Columbus, right? You know, bringing all the spices back, from the spice routes and the Silk Roads. But you talk more, and you know, and of course, in the Middle East, all we hear about is the conflict of late. And you talk about how Arabs and Jews really spent much of their history collaborating. And what did they collaborate in? But in the spice trade. So they knew so much about so many cultures. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. You're dead on target in getting right down to the intent of this book, Linda. Carlo Petrini, the founder of Slow Food, has spoken about virtuous globalization, that we need not think about globalization as only one option in the way we exchange materials and ideas between cultures. And in fact, my intent of this book was to show that throughout most of history, there was an ethics and morality about trade that gradually spread from the far reaches of Western Europe to the coast of China and down into Africa, and was shared among many spice traders and exemplified virtuous globalization. And much of this emerged out of moral and ethical precepts of Jews, Arabs, and other Semitic peoples who first lived in deserts where they had to have exchanges with people from other valleys and watersheds of foodstuffs to survive, because desert rainfall, of course, is so unpredictable that a kind of ethical exchange emerged. And it's only been since the last 400 years that that began to erode in terms of the ethical veracity shared by people that has led to the horrors of globalization that we see today.
Right. Well, going back to that region, as I said, you're also a desert ecologist, and you live in the desert now in America, right? So this was not you for you going back to this area and following these routes. Now, you followed four major routes: the spice route, the Silk Road, the frankincense route, and the Camino Real.
That's right. And the spice trail across northern Africa is, like the Silk Road, is really multiple routes. Actually, all of them can be considered multiple routes. The Silk Road, we can also talk about the maritime Silk Road between the Middle East and China, as well as the overland routes through Central Asia.
Oh, so that encompasses a lot more stuff. Well, for the sake of the early spices that we read about in early texts, and certainly in old stories from the Bible, and about frankincense being one of the earliest. Tell us what the frankincense route, why this became such an important route, because my question initially was, well, what grows in the desert? And frankincense is certainly
one of them. That's right. So deserts have very low productivity, of course, because of low rainfall, but they also have plants whose fragrances and flavors have been intensified by the heat, drought, and very mineralized soils of the desert. So, ironically, it's low productivity but high potency, not only of culinary spices, but medicinal plants, spiritual incenses, and even hallucinogens. And yet a lot of these have very restricted distributions, as frankincense and myrrh do. There's different kinds of frankincense and myrrh, but each of them has a peculiar potency that's associated with one particular landscape. So something called transit trade began between these areas, as nomads would harvest one of these very, very potent herbs or fruits or gums like frankincense and trade it to agricultural peoples around desert oases who, of course, could grow staple crops with some reliability and yield stability. So I was blessed to be able to go to the natal grounds of frankincense trade on the Oman-Yemen border and see the incredible ethics that Semitic peoples had developed to protect these populations from over-exploitation. And, I mean, we're talking about 3,500 years of the use of a plant population without over-exploiting it.
And these are the gnarly-looking trees that sit all alone.
That's right. I mean, it reminds me when you mentioned that you and I are both in love with heirloom apples, that my hard cider-making friends always say the best flavors and fragrances come from the gnarliest apples that are so ugly that you wouldn't want to put them on the dessert plate, but they're terrific for cider. And the same thing is true with these trees. They look tortured, and the frankincense resins themselves are called tears. They're shaped like tears. They look like tears, and it's as if the tree has been wounded by the wind or the knife of a harvester, and that they're crying out to the heavens to be released from this pain of living through all this drought and heat. And so, ironically, that became known as the food of the gods. The incense was not only used in spiritual ceremonies, but in erotic ceremonies among couples and as an additive to foods and beverages. And at one time, frankincense was the most highest valued commodity in the world in trade.
We're talking very expensive, correct?
That's right. I mean, and it increased a thousandfold in cost as it went from the Nejd highlands of Oman and Yemen up to Rome and Athens, where at one time Julius Caesar worried that the obsession with incenses and culinary spices was actually bankrupting the Roman Empire by creating an imbalance in the balance of trade between the outliers and the core of the empire.
Well, these Semitic peoples who traded in these spices and gathered the time, labor to gather the frankincense in particular, the sticky resin that just oozes once in a while when they, you said, graze it with their knife. But there were other spices too. I mean, my question is sort of like, why did some of them travel and some didn't, or what caused, what made some of them travel more readily?
Well, this is my hypothesis that underlies the whole book, that desert peoples would likely be impoverished and go extinct. In fact, many have, because of the paucity of natural resources they have available to them, unless they elevate, magnify, and mythologize their products beyond their caloric value. In other words, why would we trade something of 1,000 calories that weighs virtually nothing? Why would we trade it to people across a few thousand miles? It's not for the caloric, nutritional, or even the medicinal value of these plants alone. It's that desert people, by propensity and inclination, had to be great storytellers. They lived in small groups. They gathered with other people only a few times a year after traveling long distances across barren spaces. And so it was not just the chemical potency of these culinary spices and medicinal herbs and incenses that propelled them into globalized trade, but the extraordinary storytelling abilities of these spice traders. And I would say that our best chefs today are storytellers and myth shapers, not just great technicians of food preparation. And I'm thinking of Rick Bayless and Mario Batali And my friend, the James Beard Award-winning poet-chef Chris Bianco, these people create in our imaginations a space for these flavors and fragrances that last with us. And desert peoples almost by necessity had to cultivate that combination of telling people about the chemical potency of the spices and herbs that they were carrying, but also create memorable and lasting stories about them. So Herodotus in Greece thought that the frankincense grounds were protected by flying snakes who would attack anyone who came into the grounds without permission. So it's a great combination of ecology and mythology that propelled these desert spices into what later became globalized trade and included tropical and temperate plants as well.
Right. And the interesting thing is about the storytelling. There you go. You know, take television away and look what happens in the middle of the desert.
That's right.
But I found it very interesting in how you describe that these people, the Semitic tribes who were from very different regions, knew they also were multicultural and multilingual. I mean, they knew other languages. They knew all the different names that someone would call, let's say, cumin by whatever names or cinnamon by different names. And I would imagine the uses as well.
That's right. So part of what facilitated globalization was the way that spice traders were trained in sort of this ethical professional standard, that they had to go back to each of the gathering grounds themselves, if at all possible, and learn the proper way of harvesting and drying and storing and protecting potent spices from the elements. So one elegant man in his 70s that I met in Sultan Ishkashim in Afghanistan, my staff was at one point wondering whether I was trying to travel to all the axes of evil in a matter of 2 years because I kept on going to places like Afghanistan and the Yemen border. Mm. But this man had been apprenticed by his grandfather in India and the Himalayas at each place where his family sourced spices that they brokered on the Silk Road. And so it was a remarkable thing that when I asked him, looking at a jar of spices, what its name was, he said, well, in what language? I know the name of this spice in 8 to 12 different languages because I deal with people of so many different ethnicities. So these people were the original polyglots, the cultural creatives that bridge the knowledge between and among cultures.
Hmm, interesting. Let's talk about the foods that talk about what I want to get to, I guess, is culinary imperialism. Like these spices have traveled across oceans and across deserts, and they are associated most often with very exotic dishes. Do you see some negative effect on us as how this has affected us in this present-day society?
Well, absolutely. This is not glorifying or romanticizing even the spice trade done by Semitic peoples. And again, I want to remind your listeners that we sort of use the term anti-Semitism as if it's a term that only refers to the disparagement of Jewish peoples, but through most of history, we had Jewish Arabs and Arabized Jews and Phoenicians and Menaeans and Nabataeans who all integrated these spice routes and developed them into what we knew by the time Columbus and Magellan made the long distance trips by sea. But what I want to get at is that that there was certainly a redistribution of wealth that happened, particularly with the Islamic Empire first and then the Western European empires, where if a spice was costing 1,000 times what the staples of wheat or barley or rice cost, that money was being spread out along a supply chain, and it was also coming back to emperors and used by wealthy merchants to tithe the people who were allied with them in power. So, you know, by the time of the 10th or 12th century in Europe, the Radonite Jews held incredible power, greater than the power that kings and popes had. So there was kind of a culinary imperialism in what became in vogue on the tables at feasts, but there was also an economic imperialism that intensified as time went on.
Mm. Well, spices certainly throughout different periods of time have been related to those of means. You know, wealthy people were the only ones who could afford these things, whether it was the Renaissance or, you know, the going back in Roman times and Greek times, as you mentioned earlier. So,
yeah, well, that's an interesting thing that I was surprised. I thought they would be only held by the elite, but Julius Caesar in particular said these are so much in demand and desired by the middle class or lower class as a status symbol and a relief from the monotony of their lives, that's what concerned him. And I think we can say that's what concerns us today when we hear people in developing countries aspiring to the kind of wealth and consumptive excesses that Americans and Western Europeans take for granted. And we know that we're living at 50 times our carrying capacity in the United States and acquiring most of the goods for consumption and energy, right, and using an enormous portion of the world's energy to do that, and that people in the Chinese are aspiring to do the same. So the elite sets up expectations for other people, and that's when we begin to see the horrific conflicts that we've seen in all parts of the world over centuries.
Right, right. Well, what I did not mention at the top of the show is that Gary is a W.K. Kellogg Endowed Chair for Sustainable Food Systems, Professor of Sustainable Food Systems, the Endowed Chair by Kellogg, at the University of Arizona. And this brings me to what you had just said, you know, teaching sustainable food systems. And looking at this, at, as you said, Carla Petrini talking about virtuous globalization, and that, what do you feel in looking at the past and how this globalization occurred with these spice traders? Does it suggest to you anything that we could, a multicultural globalized society might be achieved in the future, some way we could reach this in the future through their practices?
Well, yes. I meditate deeply on this every day because, of course, as you said in your introduction, most of my work has been with helping revive and restore viability to local food systems. So why did I do this 8-year tangent on globalization? I think we have to learn the costs of our own that are embedded in our own history to get right about the balance between global and local, and we will all be involved in both, but we need to shift the balance towards food justice for all. So I think the tragedy that I see and that you know well is that farm workers and food service workers are the professions most likely to have to ask for food relief in this country. Mm-hmm. The people who bring us our daily bread are the ones most marginalized by how our current industrial food system works. And so we need to go deep into history and deep into what other societies have done to come up with corrective actions that can stay viable, not just over a year or two or under a small group of people who are willing to buy fair trade, but a restructuring of our whole food supply chains. I'm not a Marxist, but I think we need to listen to the powerful things that Karl Marx said about how so much of our trade and commerce has really gone wrong and created well-being only for that 1%. And so I don't want to die in a world where the disparities have doubled or quadrupled over my lifetime. I think we need to correct that.
All right. Well, you have you said that spices are not neutral, that they are imbued, and I'm putting words into what you said, but for the sake of a discussion, that spices are imbued politically, economically, and religiously with different meanings, with different effects that have brought them to us after 3,500 years of being traded. Spices are still, they're in these lands and coming from places that that have such history. And it foreshadows, as we talked about, the process of globalization. What do we think of? I mean, I'm just trying to think about the globalization of foods and trying to live in a sustainable, as you just talked about, in the sustainable world of farming. A way to make sure that, like with your work in seed saving, that this is something that we can, going forward, we can be more thoughtful, more mindful in our consumption.
Linda, you've just summarized my values and aspirations for all of us so well. I wish you'd written the jacket cover for this book. That was a really succinct summary of the issues and values embedded in this book. And, you know, I'm turning my own efforts now to things like free access public seed libraries. I'm hosting the first international forum on free access seed libraries in Tucson, May 3rd to 6th. And it's this growing movement to make sure that the choices that people have selecting seeds for their own gardens, particularly in this time of rapid climate change, aren't dominated by a few multinational seed companies that now own most of the wealth that controls transactions in seed trade.
Mm-hmm.
So we now have 440 seed libraries around the world that have emerged just over the last decade. The seed heirloom seed movement that I've been involved with for 33 years is celebrating its third of a century anniversary of the first forum on seed bank serving people. And over that time, we've had a fivefold increase in the varietal diversity of food plants and animal varieties that Americans and Canadians have access to.
Wow.
So there's some very good things happen to reverse the destructive and processes that have diminished people's options. And I think seed libraries is a good example of sort of a grassroots democratic action that's really gotten a foothold in our communities.
Yeah. Well, I see that we are running out of time, and I could go on talking about this for a long time. And I am so glad that you wrote this book and that you reported on all your travels over the years, because it adds a deeper, different voice to the whole talk of sustainable living and farming. And if we can look at what was done 3,500 years ago and apply that to our lives today, I think maybe there's hope. So Gary Nabin, thank you very much. Gary Nabin, and the author, the name of the book is Cumin, Camels, and Caravans, A Spice Odyssey. Thank you for listening to A Taste of the Past.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions anytime at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a 501c3 nonprofit. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.
Listeners, we want to tell you about a podcast we're really digging. It's called Christopher Kimball's Milk Street Radio. Every week, they travel the world to find the most fascinating stories about food, including children who harvest cod tongues after school in Norway, and a detective who tracks down food thieves. And on Milk Street Radio, you can always find the unexpected. The comedian who ranks apples using an elaborate 100-point system, the secret history of grocery stores, and how to eat your way through Italy. They also interview the most beloved names in food like Jacques Pepin, Sola Awaili, Jose Andres, Jet Tila, Ina Garten, Nigella Lawson, and Padma Lakshmi. Plus, co-hosts Christopher Kimball and Sarah Moulton do live calls with listeners and answer their questions about ingredients, techniques, and culinary mysteries. Like, why roasting a leg of lamb made one caller's oven explode? Ever wonder why your bread won't rise or your souffle falls flat? Chris and Sarah have the answers. You'll also hear from a rotating cast of contributors, including Kenji Lopez-Alt, Cheryl Day, Dan Pashman from The Sporkful, and Alex Inouz, a French guy cooking from YouTube. Take a listen at 177milkstreet.com/radio or just search your podcast app for Milk Street Radio.